Hey everyone, it's July 25th, 2017, and this is your episode 106 of At Percussion. I'm your host, Casey Cangelosi, and with me as usual are Laurel Black.
Hi.
And Megan Irons is at Interlochen.
Hello.
Megan, do you teach Interlochen every summer?
Yeah, I have for 3 years.
Oh, wow. How'd you get that gig?
Keith Aleo called me.
He has my phone number, and he's never called me. I mean, he's probably called me for something. I mean, yeah, he's called me for something, but it's never been like, hey, let me give you...
I think Keith just knew that Megan looks so good in the uniform.
Exactly. If you don't mind wearing blue every day and white on Sundays.
Then if you keep talking like that, let's have a podcast HR meeting. Walk you through the procedure. So there you go. Ben Charles is also here.
Hey there.
Megan, how's Interlochen?
Interlochen is good. I live in Missouri, so the weather is really rough this time of year. And so being up here, the weather alone is like really awesome. And the kids are great. There's just like an awesome camp vibe here. And with me here, I ran into Eli, who has asked a bunch of questions on the podcast before. And he's a huge At Percussion fan, so I invited him to join us today.
Huge fan. Great to be here. Super humbling.
And I think, as I mentioned in previous years, there are tons of percussionists here. I mean, there's the percussion faculty, but there's also percussion TA positions, percussion coordinator positions, but also percussionists who are, like, counselors and things like that. So Eli is a percussion coordinator. Can you just, like, tell us a little bit about what you do?
Yeah, it's a really awesome job here at Interlochen. I work with the stage services department and basically am responsible for pretty much all the percussion gear that's on campus, and I move it to all the different venues for all the recitals and for the concerts and for basically everything the kids and staff needed for over the entire course of the camp over the summer. And it's a really awesome job and a really cool opportunity for someone that's young and in school and in college and needs to make some money, but still wants to be around music and that incredible energy that young people have and the teachers and the faculty. So it's really cool, and I highly advise it to anyone out there looking for a job like this. It's really invaluable.
And you're an undergrad at Oberlin, right?
I'm an undergrad at Oberlin with Mike Rosen, who you had on a while
That's
ago.
Right.
And I just finished my freshman year there, so...
Awesome.
Loving it. Yeah, it's been great.
And if some, I realize you might be in this position for 15 years because it's an awesome job. But
exactly.
If someone were, and word on the street is that you're doing a great job. So, but if someone were to want to apply for one of these positions, like how did you find out about it or where?
In my case, actually one of the other guys in the percussion studio at Oberlin had worked here a year as a manager position with stage services. And I had always known about Interlochen, it has that reputation, it's just kind of like that, the Juilliard name. But he had mentioned, he kind of asked what I was doing for my summer, was I going to try to make some money or festivals, and I said that, I kind of need some money after my first year. Since he had worked there, he said, well, why don't you throw in an application for this percussion coordinator job? And he kind of described what the job entailed and what you kind of had to do. And it seemed like something I would be totally, totally up for. And basically, I contacted Keith, and I got the names of some of the people who had done it in previous years and kind of got a more real feel for what the job was like and then decided to apply. The connection was from back at school, but I was always kind of aware of the camp itself. So it's really, really cool
awesome.
To have that. So yeah, and I've definitely tried to spread the word around because it's been such a cool experience. So,
awesome.
Really enjoying it, yeah. It's really
great. Thanks for asking so many questions on the podcast, and now you can ask them live.
Yeah, of course. I'm like, my inner nerd is like going crazy because this is super cool. I've watched the show since the first episode with Brian Calhoun and just always loved and learned. I mean, learned so much, and I have a lot of friends that also really value what you guys do here. So, it's really
awesome.
Great, yeah.
Thanks. Thanks for listening.
Absolutely.
You guys, our guest today, he's a musician, a videographer, and a member of the band Square Peg Round Hole, and he's the creator of 410 Media, which hopefully he'll tell me a little more about that. I don't know much about that yet. his homemade productions have made big waves online and beyond, and gathered all sorts of attention. The CD's available for Square Peg, Round Hole, or titled Corners and Jupiter. And his 2012 solo CD is titled Spring Forward. So you guys have probably heard the name Evan Chapman. How's it going, Evan?
Good. Thank you so much for having me on here.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, our pleasure. We've got a lot of Facebook questions for you, but I wonder if you'd just tell us a little bit about maybe what you're currently up to, or maybe where you currently came from, or something recent.
Sure. So my current life kind of is comprised of the majority is 410 Media, which is my media production company, which is just a partnership between myself and a fellow percussionist and filmmaker, Kevin Eichenberg. And we specialize in shooting video, music videos, performance videos that all sort of fall under the umbrella of contemporary classical music and percussion chamber music. And so that's kind of my media by day gig. And then my by night gig is playing with Square Peg, Round Hole, which is a percussion trio, but more just a rock band. It's loud and there are loud amps and we play in clubs. But it's just so happens to be three percussionists who met at school, classical percussion majors, and have since formed a rock band together with vibes and bells and all sorts of percussion toys.
Yeah, great. You got a Facebook question there, Ben?
Yes. Well, since you mentioned your rock band, Square Peg, there was a Facebook question from Ben Millison that says, is there any specific person or band that inspired the style of music played by Square Peg? What's the process in writing music? What's the process in writing music like that?
Yeah, so I guess our original inspiration that sort of inspired us to start the group was So Percussion. I was fresh out of the So Percussion Summer Institute back in 2011. And that institute really inspired me just to start a chamber group with fellow friends and percussionists and like-minded people. Just, you know, seeing the way that So does what they do, but also the other participants all had, you know, their own groups, duos, trios, quartets, and they were just playing rep that they wanted to be playing. And so that was kind of the initial inspiration for forming the group. And we very much started out sort of in the I would still consider us still in the footsteps of So Percussion, but we started out pretty directly in their footsteps, programming a lot of the same repertoire that they played. And our first concert was Threads by Paul Lansky and some other So rep. And then after that, we kind of just went more the direction of writing our own music. We had things that we wanted to see in the percussion repertoire that we necessarily didn't see very often. So we kind of took it upon ourselves to write the music that we wanted to exist in that world. So since then, we've kind of taken those roots as a chamber group, very influenced by So Percussion, just contemporary classical chamber writing, but then blending it more with the rock inspiration and electronic inspiration that a lot of us come from. I grew up playing in rock bands and garage bands, and the other two guys had a similar history with pop music and rock music. And so slowly over the last 5 years, it's kind of just morphed into this percussion ensemble meets rock band hybrid. And that just kind of is a result of the experiences that the three of us had growing up and through school. So
speaking of pop music, you've gotten a lot of YouTube attention, at least with your just super well done, well recorded, and of course, well performed covers.
I know where this is going.
Oh, did you? I have no idea where this is going.
Oh, really? maybe Evan knows what I'm laughing about. Because if you go on Evan's YouTube channel, there's a great cover of a Backstreet Boys song.
That is the truth.
With Evan lip-syncing vocals, and it's amazing.
Yeah, I guess my YouTube content has spanned from things that I take very seriously to some more just fun, comedic, which I guess doesn't happen quite as often, but... Yeah, I mean, the YouTube thing was a big part of
part of my life, especially when I was in school, in undergrad, and kind of started with me just tinkering around with cameras and filming myself playing pieces. You know, everyone learns recital repertoire and then they play at their recital, and that's sort of like, that's that. That's the finish line of, you know, or if you continue to play it live. But I found that to be a little bit more of a concrete final product of these pieces that I was working on. Just, you know, sorry, my cat's yelling at me in the background. Hopefully it's not too distracting. but yeah. And so I just kind of started filming myself playing these pieces, just kind of as a, you know, proof of me, learning the piece and just kind of another check mark, in learning this repertoire. And then, started posting those onto my YouTube channel, as well as some drum set covers and transcriptions that I was doing of just bands that I liked and songs that I liked, including Backstreet Boys and Jimmy Eat World and, you know, whatever pop or rock song. And then kind of started to morph those two interests and began filming these percussion covers of pop songs. So I would like transcribe the harmonies and the vocal lines and background vocal lines and guitar parts. And I would arrange them for various, you know, mallet percussion and auxiliary percussion. And so I kind of make these quote unquote video songs, kind of inspired by Jack Conti, if anyone is familiar with his work with Pomplamoose, just sort of like this, every sound has an accompanying visual, and just kind of these quick cuts between all these different overdubs. And so that was kind of a big thing that I did for a little while. And since then, it's sort of broken off from that into just filming these videos for other people, which is sort of where 410 was spawned from, the media production company. I don't have so much time to just do it of myself anymore, but I would consider that to be a pretty strong just kind of background of where that came from.
So I had a question about you talked about recording other people, and I know one of the first recordings I saw that you had done of someone else was Rob Kosterman's recording of the David Lang piece, whose name escapes me now. But was that when you started recording other people, were they asking you, did you offer, were they paying you? Like, how did this sort of business idea start up?
Yeah, it started
Unchained Melody, that's the name of the piece.
Yeah, Unchained Melody, great piece, and Rod totally killed that recording. Yeah, it sort of was just a matter of word getting out to my fellow colleagues that I was interested in filming things and taking pictures of things, and so people started to kind of have the same desire that I had, which is that they were learning pieces for various recitals and performances, and they just wanted to have a nice product of it online, a nice representation of it. And so, and it's nice that I got into the video work while I was in school, because that meant that there were a lot of people that sort of like allowed me to mess around, and, you know, it was a lot of trial and error and figuring out different camera techniques and audio recording techniques. And that's like about the best test subjects that you can have, is a bunch of, you know, a bunch of your friends who are also in a music major who also just want to put out cool creative things. And so a lot of those people just trusted me to make recordings of their pieces. Off the bat, it was definitely a lot of free or very cheap work. It was just kind of like hanging out with my friends in the rehearsal rooms after hours and, you know, just filming these videos. But then gradually kind of became a little more concrete, and it was people actually hiring me to film their recitals, which sort of became like a side hustle to help pay for, you know, being in college, and ended up staying really busy with that. I mean, during recital season, it was filming 2, 3, 4 recitals a weekend, every weekend, and it became a pretty big part of my life. And then to the point where once I graduated, I just went straight into filming for Indiana University, being hired by the university to shoot promotional materials for the opera and ballet and departments. So it was kind of a gradual progression from like free fun work with friends to like paid work for real people who, you know, who were giving me paychecks. So
How has, since, you know, you said you started filming yourself and making, you know, creative videos, when you're, I guess two questions. One, when you're filming other people, when other people hire you, do you see it as a collaborative project? And do you think that people see you as, you know, one of the reasons they hire you is because that they know that you're collaborative? And, you know, how much artistic input do you have into that video? And how, the second question is, how has that kind of altered your, you as an artist? Like, are you still playing a ton? Are you still making videos of yourself? And, or do you find that now you're just more time is being spent with other people's music?
Yeah, so I'll start with the second question. I have definitely found, in terms of the video work, it's sort of taken over doing it for other people. I still do a lot of video work with Square Peg, and that's kind of, it's really nice to have that outlet to continue to be able to shoot our music videos and in-studio videos and whatever. Just because, you know, once I graduated, just kind of finding the time and the attention span to, like, do these recording sessions by myself has just, it's become a little harder to come by just because I have all this other stuff going on, and it's hard for me to dedicate the same time that I could back in school when I wasn't, you know, people weren't relying on me to get things done for, you know, that was an actual job. It was just kind of like my free time was free time, and I could either do an assignment or I could film myself, and usually ended up filming myself. And then back to the first question, I'm definitely, and Kevin is in the same boat, my partner with 410. We're often really grateful to be working with people who respect our, you know, our backgrounds as percussionists and are interested in hearing our ideas as collaborators. And it's always kind of a funny inquiry when someone will say, like, we want you guys to just do, like, the 410 treatment to this, like, you know, do your thing. And just because we have certain lighting techniques and camera techniques that we, you know, kind of gravitate towards, and we've been fortunate enough to work with a lot of people who sort of entrust us to do those things and kind of make the videos that we think would be appropriate. And so those are always really fun projects, and especially the projects where people are playing repertoire that either we've played or, you know, music that we really like as percussionists. And that kind of allows us to, like, really dive in and, like, it's like, man, it would be awesome to shoot a video of this just because I love this piece a lot, or I've played this piece before and I would love to, you know, kind of approach the piece from a different perspective, which is as a filmmaker and an audio engineer, instead of, like, the one actually hustling through the notes.
Sure.
Ben, what do you have for us today?
Yeah, so speaking of the sort of filmmaking and interdisciplinary music film sort of stuff, I thought a great topic to talk about today was Thierry Demay. And I know that Evan has recorded table music, so I'd like to hear about that in a bit, of course. But just a quick little tiny bit of biographical information on Thierry Demay. He was born on February 28, 1956 in Brussels, Belgium. And from his bio, I thought there was a great quote that sort of summed him up. It says he has an instinctive feel for movement, which guides his entire work, allowing him to tackle and integrate a variety of disciplines. He's created interdisciplinary works for film, as well as he's collaborated extensively with different choreographers. In June 1993, he joined the faculty of IRCAM in France to develop several computer music programs and give courses in composition and lectures on the relationship between dance and music. And as far as the percussion perspective, it appears that Jean Geoffroy is sort of his frequent percussion performer collaborator. The problem with Thierry Demay is it seems that a lot of his works aren't very well cataloged or dispersed in the U.S., so I found a bunch of works with very little info on them, mostly from the IRCAM website. So I just wanted to sort of run through the titles of, I think it's five percussion works here, before I get to the ones that we really will get into for today. In 1984, he wrote a piece called Ballatum, which was written for a chamber music group that he started with Peter Viermensch called Maximalist. It's for a dancer and six percussionists. There's a piece from 1990 called Air, for a percussion solo with electronics. And actually, I think 1990 was the date of the recording. I couldn't actually find the date of the piece, but the recording is on YouTube. It's a very cool sounding piece. Don't really know anything about it other than that, unfortunately. He wrote a piece from 1995 to 96 called Unknownness for percussion and sampled sounds. He has a percussion sextet with cello and electronics from 2002 called Water, which I thought could maybe be a very interesting pairing with Alejandro Vignal's percussion sextet, Water. And he has a piece from 2008 called April Suite, which is actually, it seems, just four of his other pieces just put together. So the first movement is Silence Must Be. The second movement is called Mountain for three percussionists. The third movement is called Earth for six percussionists. And the fourth movement is called Piece of Gestures for five percussionists. And there's a little clip of an excerpt of that conducted by Jean Geoffroy on Vimeo, if you want to look that up. The works that people are, I think, most familiar with are his Musique de Table, or Table Music in English, which is from 1987. It's the subtitle is A Ballet for Three Sets of Hands. And so I'm sure Evan will tell us about recording it. But it's basically everyone has a little wooden table, and all the notation is graphic, and it represents all these different sort of swishing motions that you make over the tables. Most people do it with contact mics on the table, so you can really hear all the scrapes and pops on the tables. He has a piece called Frisking Prolationum for 11 percussionists from 1990. It's originally for six percussionists and five winds, and it appears, based on what I could translate from French, that it's now a version for 11 percussionists. The instrumentation was created by Thierry Demey, including metal rods, styrofoam, mirrors, paper drums, and piano frames amplified by contact mics or electric guitar pickups. And in the wind version, it seems that the wind instruments were mostly used for extended techniques like breathing sounds and key clicks. He has a piece from 2002 that I mentioned earlier called Silence Must Be, which I know Casey has performed extensively. And there are two versions of it. One is for conductor, so to speak, with a pre-recorded audio. And then there's also a version with live audio. But basically, it's sort of like Aphasia by Mark Applebaum in that it's gestures coordinated to sounds. And then the last piece I wanted to talk about is from 2004. It's called Light Music. And there's a, if you Google it, you can find a little interview with Adam Rosenblatt, who's a Robert Van Cise student, on performing light music. But basically, the performer is moving their hands through a sort of light field that's picked up by a computer program, and the gestures that the performer's hands make will create different sounds based on this computer program. And there's also sort of a trippy, delayed visual aspect of a projection of the performer's hands. So that is, unfortunately, all I can really find about Thierry Demey's works, because it seems information is limited and largely in French. But
Evan, why don't you go first?
Sure. So table music has a lot of elements to it that make it fun to record, both audio-wise and visually. On the audio end of things, just having, you know, contact mics to play with when you're mixing is really fun. When we recorded it, we just had a contact mic on these wooden platforms. And just being able to kind of juice out certain frequencies from these contact mics is really fun, just from an audio mixing standpoint.
It seems to me like it's a piece that actually almost works better recorded than live. You can kind of get close-up shots and, like, better audio, yeah.
Totally. And visually, any piece that has a lot of gestural material, I definitely think lends themselves well to visual representation, because you can get the lens right up on the different movements, and you can really see them better than if you were sitting, you know, 10 or 15 rows back in a recital hall. That video was pretty simple setup-wise. I just lit it in a way that only the hands were illuminated for most of it. And so the performers were wearing black, and the lights weren't shining on their faces except for one part where they turn and look at each other, or they look to the side. And so it really allowed you to only focus on the hands and the movements that were going on there. So, yeah, there are just a couple things about that piece that make it really fun to document visually and audio-wise.
And one thing I forgot to mention, one of my favorite things about table music is that the score for it actually becomes a prop in the piece. for example, the first page turn, the page turn itself actually happens as a fugue between three performers, which then sets off an actual fugue within the music. So, yeah, it's got all sorts of cool little things like that in it.
Absolutely.
I think my favorite thing about table music specifically is the notation. And you bring it to students, and I know when I was a student and I got to do it for the first time, it just looks so daunting. And it looks like, wow, there are so many symbols, and why does this have to be this hard? Why do we have to learn all these many, many, many symbols? But as you see...
It makes sense after a while, yeah.
Yeah, it's great, because it's a really great example of, like, hey, don't just write a fancy notation for the sake of writing a fancy notation. It's a really good lesson in inventing a language that you need, and it's great because the things he makes, you end up thinking like, oh yeah, that's not only a way that makes sense to write it, but that's the best way to write it. Like, I can't think of a better way to write this whole new system and language for these little hand gestures and these hand motions. And it's great because he slowly builds the piece, starts really simple, and he kind of builds on the language, and eventually the things just become really intuitive. And it's really idiomatic rather than so abstract.
It's sort of a masterclass in two things for composers. One, it's a masterclass in exactly what Casey just talked about in terms of coming up with graphic notation that makes sense and is intuitive. It's also a masterclass in terrible engraving, unfortunately. it's so hard to read some of the stuff. Like, once you know what it is, you can read it, but like trying to get out your magnifying glass and look up blurry French words, it's tough.
Yeah, no doubt. The other one is Silence Must Be that Ben mentioned, and this piece I really like so much to perform, of course, but also to use in my lectures. So I've got a clinic about music and it being, you know, able to be more than just entertainment and being able to explain concepts and teach us good lessons and things like that. And Silence Must Be is a really good one to use because you don't have to look at any chord structures, you don't have to look at key areas, you don't have to look at intervals, so you can really use it for anybody. I've used it for music appreciation courses, I've used it for just general audiences, I've used it for really young students, and it's just a really, really good example of how a piece can convey a concept. So of course, I don't want to lay that all down here for you guys here on the fly, but the gist of it being, you know, the whole piece is based on a conflicting pulse within the body and how it can transfer from one side of you to another, and how those two pulses can kind of find silence and find peace. And it's a, you know, it's a nice conceptual piece about inner understanding or inner peace or something of that sort. At least that's how I see it.
Cool.
Yeah. How about another Facebook question for Evan, you guys? Anybody have one handy? I've got one. How about Brandon Arve? He says, do you have a starter's list of audio and video gear you wouldn't mind sharing?
Yeah. So generally, I guess with that question, quality definitely beats quantity. You know, kind of the specifics of whether you're a Canon person or a Nikon person or whatever, those are kind of up to preference. But my big suggestion is to opt for one nice camera, one nice lens, and, you know, one or two nice microphones over sort of getting maybe a couple not so nice cameras or microphones or whatever. And the benefit of it being 2017 and technology being what it is, you know, cameras that can shoot full 1080 at 24 frames per second and, you know, whatever capabilities have become extremely affordable in the last 5 years, even 5 to 10 years. And so I guess I could recommend what I started out on, which was just Canon kind of lower end DSLRs. I bought a T1i first and sold that and bought a T3i, which are now no longer being produced, but you can get them on eBay for $200 or $300, I think. But even to get a new camera, if you, you know, if you get a Canon, I'm not sure what TEI they're on at this point, but, you know, just a, an entry or medium level DSLR has gotten pretty affordable, just a couple hundred bucks. I will say that there are a lot of other factors that are arguably more important than the equipment that you're using. For example, the location that you're in, the lighting that you're using, you know, just these various things that are kind of more important than the actual camera body that you buy. Yeah, if you kind of get just one okay DSLR with a lens that can kind of cover, you know, if you get sort of a middle of the line focal length, it's like a 30 millimeter or 50 millimeter or something, and there's one or two microphones with an interface, maybe just a couple of SM57s, which are $100, but. Overall, that, like I said, just being in a nice hall and knowing where to put a light, these are all things that are more important than the specifics of the gear that you're using. I always kind of laugh. On some of my older YouTube videos, I was using a pretty primitive setup. It was like the built-in microphone on my MacBook at the time to record audio, and it was a Canon T1i DSLR, which is a pretty entry-level camera. It's not really a professional camera by any means. And I would always get these people that are asking, like, what microphones are you using, and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, it's just the built-in mic, but I, you know, I dumped it in GarageBand and EQ'd it appropriately and put reverb on it appropriately and compressed it. And so just kind of knowing how to work with what you have, I think, is a little more important than the specifics of the gear. I know that's not like exactly the answer that everyone wants to hear, but it's sort of like the analogy of, like, you know, if Nancy Zaltzman is playing a you know, a cheap marimba, she can probably make it sound really beautiful. But if you play a high-end, you know, Malotec or whatever, but you're kind of bashing it and you're not in a nice sounding room, then it's not going to sound good. So I think the same thing applies to audio and video gear.
I had a gear question for anyone that's not super familiar with what Evan's talking about with DSLRs. He's talking about, was it digital single light reflex? Is that right? It's basically, it's like the type of camera that people use to shoot weddings or something like that, like a nice digital camera. There's also a separate category of camcorders, which are like dedicated video cameras. Could you talk about which of those you would recommend, and maybe they're different for different purposes? Because I know that the DSLRs now can shoot very good video, which confuses me that camcorders are sort of in the same price range, but people seem to still prefer the
Yeah, DSLRs are kind of an interesting thing because they have a lot of features that are desirable in video cameras and digital camcorders. But they're still primarily still photo cameras. And so they have some pretty major setbacks that don't quite make them ideal for sort of just like setting them up and letting them run during a concert. Most notably, just kind of these video file size limits where you can only shoot with the Canons, it's 12 minutes at a time. And unless you kind of hack into the actual firmware of the camera, you kind of just have to keep pressing restart the video. You know, just things like that. And so while they're really nice for people who want to have one camera that they go to for both photo and video, which is a huge plus, being able to do both on the same camera and be able to use the same lens, no matter whether you're doing photo or video. But yeah, it just kind of has some setbacks that are kind of purposefully setbacks so that they don't get too good and they don't replace these dedicated video cameras. So yeah, I think there are kind of benefits to going with the DSLR, but there are also some setbacks that if you really want to dive into video as your main use for that gear, it's kind of worth just shelling out the money and getting a camcorder. And, you know, that also applies to like the audio settings, just being able to plug in XLRs into a video camera, you know, just various things that make it more preferable.
one question, and I have to admit that I am one of those people that called up Evan and said, like, dude, so, like, what microphone do I need to sound better? And actually, Evan very generously and kindly told me exactly what he just told you all. Like, well, it's not so much the magic mic that's going to do it. It's much more how you treat the sound. And, yeah, I mean, this is totally a craft. You know, there's not some magic secret of brilliant gear. But I have to say the microphone you recommended, we did buy. And, yeah, we do love it. It's worked out so nice. But the big secrets, yeah, were learning how to use the gear and not just so much having the right piece of gear. But speaking of gear, it seems like just a few years ago, the standard startup little recording kit, back to Brandon Arve's question, was, like you said, laptop, sound interface, and then a couple of mics, be them, you know, the AKG CS1000, or which I love, or the standard SM57, SM58, one of those. What do you think of USB mics? Like, what if you just didn't do... What if you went without the sound interface and you're just a studio guy and you want to record your recital or your audition tape? What do you think of USB mics out there nowadays?
Yeah, unfortunately, I can't speak too well to those mics just because I personally haven't really ever used one, I don't think. But I think it kind of just depends on what you want to accomplish out of the equipment that you have. And so whether you're if your one goal is to just kind of be able to document your own performances really well, or to do a podcast, or, you know, whatever your specific needs may be, I think that could be a perfect thing. If you only see yourself needing, you know, one input for what you're going to be doing, I think like a USB mic would be perfect. But if you have plans to eventually expand your setup, whether that's like, you know, eventually you would want to record your full drum set, or whether you want to be able to multi-track a percussion ensemble recording and be able to put a different mic on each, you know, mallet instrument, then it's worth shelling out the money and maybe getting a 4-channel interface. But if you're a podcast host and like you only see yourself needing one microphone, then you should just, yeah, invest in one good microphone that just plugs right into your computer, and that's that.
I consider myself a podcast host.
You're great at it.
Hey, Megan, I think you have something for us about sound today, right?
I do. Yeah, I had this really interesting experience the other day. I'm pulling up my segment here. I've been doing some yoga recently, and at the yoga studio I've been attending, there was a poster for a sound bath, and I was like, what in the world is a sound bath? Like, is there water involved? Like, what is a public bath? Like, what is that? And so I did like a quick internet search to make sure it wasn't a public bath. And then I signed up for it. And then I got on the waiting list and I was kind of bummed. I was like, I really want to find out what this is. And luckily I got off the waiting list and I was able to attend the sound bath. And I arrived and it was, you know, it was packed, and it was crazy. So I just wanted to share my experience during the sound bath with you. And then I'll tell you a little bit about what I read. But we started with kind of like some meditation and yoga. It kind of felt like a yoga class, except you weren't moving your body at all the entire time. You're just laying flat, or whatever position feels comfortable to you. And throughout the course, I guess it was about an hour. Throughout the course of the hour, there were different sounds that were played that were supposed to like speak to different and interact with different parts of your body. At first they were using their voice to kind of explain some of these things and explain the different sounds. So for example, they had like these crystal singing bowls, and they would say, you know, this singing bowl, I can't remember exactly what they said, something is supposed, you know, something about your mind, something in your head or whatever, something about the crown of your head, and the different parts that you think that you focus on in Chaturanga and in yoga as well. So it was almost kind of like it was defining what sound goes with what part of the body, sort of, to me. And then in the middle, they moved into a portion where it's just sound. And then back at the end, they incorporated some singing with it. But the part that was really well, first of all, I wanted to tell you about sounds that were used.
So real quick, so no water involved.
There was only a little bit of spritzing of water or something on everyone as they walked past. Felt like holy water or something. It reminded me of church. So there are these different sizes of crystal singing bowls. There was a gong. There's a drum. There's a didgeridoo. Yeah. There were different kinds of bells and wind chimes. And I think that was it. And so these were played in the center of the room, and everyone was kind of, you know, spread out around them. But they also traveled as well. So they're like two people. And your eyes are closed the entire time. So, you know, once you really kind of get into a meditative state, it's kind of crazy to think, to kind of spatialize where these sounds are coming from. But yeah, they walk around the room, and so sometimes it would play something like right next to your ear, and then right next to this ear, sometimes right over you. At one point, they had a tuning fork, and they touched it to my head. That was pretty crazy. Wow. Like a giant tuning fork. So it was an interesting experience, I would have to say, as a percussionist. I was wary going into it, but also very curious and open. And I think my experience was maybe hindered a little bit by being a percussionist and by being a musician, just because we listened so carefully. So it was very hard for me to kind of turn off the analytical side and like, what instrument is that? What is that? And, you know, oh, they could be totally using a better mallet for that. Are these people percussionists? Oh my God. It took me a while to like get out of that. And the air conditioning was running, and there was like some noise from outside, so that really bothered me too. So I would like to experience it like in a completely sound isolated room, maybe as a private session also. I guess I'm, you know, a very picky sound bather. But anyway, it was an interesting experience, and yes. So I looked up some more information about it afterwards. I said, what in the world is this? And I shared an article with you guys from Quartz magazine. And I also looked up a few other things. But the author of the Quartz magazine, the author's experience was this. I don't feel as if I've traveled to a different astral plane, but I feel calm, a feeling that lasts as we bid goodbye and head out into LA traffic, fading slowly like the trailing echo of a gong. So that was interesting to hear their experience as well. So what exactly is it? It's listening to percussive instruments like gongs, Tibetan singing bowls, and tuning forks. They reduce stress and can place the listener in a meditative state. Practitioners offer their services as an alternative treatment for problems like anxiety, chronic pain, sleep disorders, and PTSD. Sound healing is having a moment. There are sound healing meetups in LA, London, Chicago, and more than 5,000 people are listed in the member directory of Boulder, Colorado-based Sound Healers Association. The LA Times actually listed one of Ford's sound baths in its annual holiday gift guide. And sorry, but Ford is the owner of the studio that's doing the sound baths in this article. So yeah, it's definitely a thing. But is it real? That's the question. And evidence of using sound, music, and chants to heal the sick dates back to thousands of years to ancient Egyptians and Australia's Aborigines. It's not a regulated industry, although several different associations offer correspondence certification courses with modules like, quote, the sound of love, unquote, and, quote, how to achieve dominant outward radiation, unquote. Another article that I read on a website called Mind Body Green says that sound helps to facilitate shifts in our brainwave state by using entrainment. Entrainment synchronizes our fluctuating brainwaves by providing a stable frequency which the brainwave can attune to. By using rhythmic frequency, we can entrain our brainwaves, and it then becomes possible to downshift our normal beta state, or our normal waking consciousness, to alpha, or related consciousness, and even reach theta, which is a meditative state, and delta, which is sleep, where internal healing can occur. The same concept is utilized in meditation by regulating the breath, but with sound, it's the frequency that is the agent which influences the shift. So it makes sense. That makes sense to me because maybe sound isn't the thing that allows me to get into that state, but maybe yoga or moving, you know, different parts of the body is maybe what works more for me. So we're getting a little bit more scientific in that description. And as it stands, sound healing does not really stand up to scientific scrutiny. So there's a professor of audio signal processing at the University of Southern California named Chris Kyriakis, and his area of study is how the human brain translates sound waves into perceptible sounds. And what he says about sound therapy, sound healing, or sound baths is there's no scientific published peer-reviewed paper that supports any of these claims. They're all cool claims. It would be nice if some of them were true, but there's no science whatsoever that supports any of these claims. However, to kind of leave on a positive note, going back to the Mind, Body, and Spirit website, they say, our body, mind, and spirit always wants to be moving in a direction toward balance. Yet we often have too much outer stimulus and noise and not enough time to dedicate to ourselves, which can prevent us from achieving a better state of harmony. Sound has a way of helping us get to the source of this inner peace we all desire. And of course, we can all relate this to our musical experiences that we have probably every day, which is another part of that article if anyone wants to check out the rest of the article. But I'm curious if any of you have heard of sound healing, sound therapy, or attended a sound bath. And if you haven't, I do encourage you to try it.
I have not, but I have a friend that I met up with for lunch a week ago or so, and he told me he did something, and I can't remember what it's called, but it sounded similar. He said that his was a solo session, and he was placed on some sort of bed, and they put, like, I think his eyes were closed the whole time, but they put these, like, warm crystals on top of him. And then he said at some point the lady that was doing this, it was something healing session, had the Tibetan singing bowls that she was doing. He said that was like his favorite part and the most sort of out of mind experience that he had there.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah,
we just rented these giant, like the lowest octave of Taigongs that you can get for a piece we're performing next week, not here at Interlaken, but at Mizzou. And, like, the day after that, I was explaining it to someone, and I was in a rehearsal with these gongs, and I just, like, hit the gong. I'm like, that's sound therapy for me. I would like to just sit next to this gong for an hour, just be totally up close to it.
Yeah.
So it sounds like, from what I can read, and I have no experience with this and haven't attended one of these sound baths or anything, but I do like that the Quartz article said, yeah, they've been doing scientific tests for years, and there's nothing scientific about any of this, but scientists and modern medicines do agree that yoga, meditation, sound therapies, they can be good for you, certainly, but they're good for you for different reasons. Like, what they claim is happening is definitely not happening, but that doesn't mean it's not good for you. And that doesn't mean that meditation isn't useful and isn't a really, really healthy thing. Of course, where homeopathy gets scary is when you have people like, say, how we lost Steve Jobs. They're told, hey, you have pancreatic cancer. Well, you don't need to see a traditional doctor. You can eat it away by eating the right things, and you can do the right things, and you can use these homeopathic treatments, and it happens all the time. People then, you know, they die because they're thought to believe that, you know, they can cure it with this other thing. But I do agree with the article. Like, this is, like, it's really neat, and it's really cool to know where some of our instruments come from and some of their traditions and some of their uses. So it sounds to me like sound baths, the reasoning behind them is sort of a mix of both Tibetan and Chinese, traditional Chinese medicine. So it's kind of a mixture of those two. So what I found is that the general belief is that there's kind of a universal sound and resonance in the universe. All the planets, Earth and us, we all have this, what they call is a sound resonance. All celestial bodies have a harmonic resonance with each other, including the Earth and our bodies. In our bodies, this is chakra, which is in the Indian tradition, we have our seven chakras, and these are meridian pathways in Chinese medicine and acupuncture. Modern sound healing borrows from both these two ideas. So the gongs in sound baths are supposedly resetting your meridian pathways. And one sound healer says, sound is the basis of creation and the universe. In Taoism, the Tao is described by Lao Tzu as the great tone. In the Vedanta tradition, which is a type of Hindu philosophy, the Nada Brahma describes the world as sound. And of course, even in Christian faith, John 1:1 says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And even in modern science, says this person, that atoms have their own frequency patterns. Atoms combine to make molecules, which combine to make larger structures, and eventually cells, which eventually make us. Thus, we have our own frequencies, and all of our smaller parts have frequencies. So, thus, we are also frequency patterns within the universal resonance, and the idea is that you have these tuned instruments, and when the sound washes over you, yes, of course, you feel it, but also you hear it, but also your body feels it. And of course, there's no way it could work like this, because if your atoms have a frequency, how could your sound be vibrating your individual atoms and like not destroy you? So anyway, and also how could really dissonant music not destroy your body? You know, so anyway, it is really fascinating though, and I like what Megan said about the specific chakrable pitches, because there are seven chakras, and they do have pitches. So this is old news to, I'm sure, a lot of our listeners, because this is really, really basic stuff. But see if I can remember it off the top of my head, because my thing's not pulling up. So yeah, the lowest chakra is the root. It's like where you're sitting. The next one is the sacral, which is like in your crotch. The next one is your solar plexus, and then the heart, which is in your heart, and then the throat, the third eye, which is on your forehead, and then the crown. Megan referred to the crown. So those pitches correspond, and each part of a chakra has to do with various aspects of your life and your personality. So, for example, the third chakra is the solar plexus, and its color is yellow, and its musical pitch is E. And let's see, what does it have to do with? It's usually associated with self-confidence, self-esteem, self-respect, fear, intimidation, and responsibility for making decisions for yourself and others. So these healers will do things like, if you're having a problem like that in your world, they will focus on your third chakra and thus focus on E. So you'll need a lot of E to readjust and realign that chakra, supposedly. So I think it's like really beautiful ideas, but yeah, you know, is it true? No. Does it work? Yeah, totally. People really dig it.
Yeah, absolutely. To kind of chime in, I really also really like the idea of that, even though there isn't necessarily any really hard scientific evidence. I really like the idea of us using sound as a catalyst to kind of get to those places and to trigger those ways of being relaxed in a calm state. I've never actually done any of these sound baths or sound healing sessions, but I've heard a lot about them, friends and family who have done them. And just as like my own personal experience, I'm not really ashamed to admit, but we had two racks of tuned nipple gongs, two octaves worth of nipple gongs on these racks at school and in the basement. And one evening I kind of went in there, and I wasn't really in the best mental state, and I went in there kind of frustrated, and I kind of just, as we tend to do, I tapped on the gongs with my fists, and they all started vibrating, and the pitches kind of created this really beautiful blend of sound, and I just kind of sat and folded my legs and kind of almost meditated in that sound for about 10 to 15 minutes, just kind of whatever, every so often hit the gongs and kind of just sit there. And that blend of sound that was being created, when I hit all the gongs, kind of put me in this meditative state. I sat there and listened for a second and really tried to soak in what that felt like and to really kind of be at peace for a second and calm down and slow down. And there really is something to be said to be in that, being closed in that, in the middle of all these vibrations going on and the feelings and the places that your mind goes, you know, naturally if you let it. So even though there's not anything really, you know, hard science to back any of this stuff up, I do think it's a really interesting idea and definitely an experience, at least, that's definitely worth experimenting with, because at least from my own personal kind of fooling around, I was, it helped me to at least kind of slow down for a second and really air out. So that was really nice. So I think it's really, really cool.
Cool.
Yeah.
And just one thing to tie it back together, thanks for explaining all those chakras, Casey.
Yeah.
Because that was one thing I thought, like, as a musician, being able to identify those pitches and be able to think about like what part of the body we were working on when they weren't using words. That whole middle section I kind of described, that was helpful for me to really stay focused rather than, you know, listening kind of aimlessly, but really to focus on like what part of the body or what chakra we were in, you know, that might be more difficult for non-musicians.
Well, it's nice. It just kind of adds a little bit of dimension and meaning, you know, when you see George Crumb's Macrocosmos, and it has singing bowls, and it has gongs, and you know, it has a lot of instruments that have a history. It's cool to know that, you know, these are sacred to a lot of people, and this is specifically specifically. Anything to say with that, Evan? I feel like you haven't said anything in a little while.
I don't know. I mean, honestly, this has been a big learning process for me. I didn't know too much about this going into this. Pretty much my only personal experience with it is a very unofficial way, which is just that I really love just sort of the just kind of ambient music in general, and just kind of letting these frequencies just sort of happen and be immersive. And the music that I tend to gravitate towards when I'm just listening to music, as opposed to the music that I'm playing or filming or whatever. Usually it's, you know, during drives or during at the end of long days or whatever. And I always gravitate towards extremely, you know, minimal music and ambient music. And I could be totally content just listening to like a low sine wave for an hour and like just, you know, kind of letting that do whatever it does to, you know, your productivity and your body. And so that's kind of my unofficial vantage point towards all this, is just that, I can totally appreciate it.
I don't know if you guys ever listened to Giacinto Chelsea, the composer. I think I've talked about him before, but a lot of microtonality and a lot of his inspirations are from supposedly just what a tam-tam sounds like, just like all the different little sound masses, all the overtones, and just how much is in there, which is why he'll just have a focal pitch that this whole piece is based on, and so many things like swirl in and out of it. It's the extreme opposite of what we're talking about. It's very, very dissonant, but it's really, really, it's amazing. I love that music.
I'm sure that it sounds like probably Evan is also a Brian Eno fan, and Brian Eno is sort of the master of ambient music. And I've talked about this before, but he has an album called Music for Airports. He has four albums called, I think it's Ambient 1, 2, 3, and 4. And Ambient 1 is Music for Airports. And it's just tape loops that are played, and they're very kind of calm and slow. And I was traveling this week, and I always listen to Music for Airports when I'm in the airport, because it's such a busy, chaotic place that that always sort of slows me down and relaxes me.
Absolutely, yeah. Brian Eno, and specifically the Music for Airports, those are my jams.
Yeah. And then he has, I think it's the third one, there's like maybe five tracks on it. I think the first three are called like The Dance 1, 2, and 3. And it's a little more rhythmic. It's sort of Steve Reich rhythmic, where it's cyclical. And sort of, I think it's actually sort of phases like Steve Reich. But yeah, it's the same sort of just, if you need to just clear your head, put that on.
Totally.
So I think we've got one last question that isn't within what we've already talked about, and it's from Daniel Seibert. And he says, and you'll have to tell me about this because I don't know anything about this, but how did you get the gig as touring drummer for Lydia? I suppose Lydia is a band, right?
Yes. Yeah, Lydia is a band. Lydia is a band that actually I've been a fan of since high school. They've been making music for a while now, and I was admittedly a fanboy back in like my sophomore and junior year of high school. I had seen them live in Baltimore, and through kind of a crazy coincidence, which also kind of drives my point home of the importance of visual representation and having a YouTube presence and social media presence. I had filmed a drum cover of a song called Barracuda, Capital of the World by this band, Oceana, that I'm a huge fan of. And Lydia was about to go on tour, and their guitarist was kind of just browsing YouTube drum covers for some reason late at night. He was just bored and looking around, and specifically Oceana drum covers, and he came across the video that I had filmed, and I just woke up to this email that was like, hey, my name's Justin. I play for this band called Lydia. And of course, I knew all about Lydia, and I'd been a fan for many years. And pretty much just, we need a drummer for this upcoming tour. I came across your YouTube channel and was really impressed and wondering if you would want to do that. And so I was just like, okay, I have a lot of things booked when this tour is happening, but I would love to do it. And so I kind of just like hustled and rearranged my schedule and made it happen. And so that led to, I've now done 3 tours with them, 2 headlining tours and 1 tour opening for a band called Paris. And they've been full national tours. And it's been really amazing, just kind of learning more about that side of the music industry that I hadn't really come into contact with very much before that.
It's funny. That's exactly how I got my Chicago Symphony Orchestra gig. Totally different. Bass drum cover right now.
Yeah, exactly. Except YouTube videos. Something that I always stress to people is just, putting up good representation of you playing online, because you never know who's going to see it. And in my case, it, as this band that I've been a fan of for 10 plus years, happened to randomly stumble across this video, and it led to playing the biggest shows that I'd ever played. And so YouTube is just an amazing resource for networking and getting your name out there as a player. Those tours have just taught me a ton about the music industry in general, and kind of more of the businessy side of things, which I was naive about going into it, but just, how booking works and how management companies work and all these, various agencies, and how to work with people at a venue that's, run by a union and people are setting up your drums for you. And it's just like this whole world that I didn't know anything about. And I've kind of walked away from that with a lot of information that I found to be really valuable, kind of bringing it back home to the projects that I've done in the meantime, other than Lydia.
Dan Seiber also asked, was there an audition process? Did they invite you for an audition based on what they saw on YouTube?
There wasn't an official audition. They just asked me to film videos of some actual Lydia drum covers, I guess, technically. So I guess it was sort of like an online audition, but I just uploaded like 5 or 6 covers, which was actually pretty easy because there were songs that I had already been listening to for a while. And so I didn't actually have to sit down and do a lot of transcribing. I was just like, hey, I know that song. I'll play it. And so I just uploaded a playlist of me playing some of their songs just to make sure that just for them to make sure that I could hang with their style of music too. And turned out to be fine.
That's way cool. Congrats. That's so many people's dream, you know?
Thanks. Yeah, it was like definitely a lot of those shows were really surreal, especially the ones that were opening for Paris, because Paris is on kind of the next tier up from Lydia in terms of headcounts at the venues, and just a lot of like surreal moments of playing for these crowds. And but they, both worlds kind of have their pros and cons. Like I really love playing really small, intimate shows on vibraphone, for like 5 people who are really into it. But then there's also something really exciting about playing these loud rock shows to, to full rooms.
Okay, so Lydia found you based on your YouTube channel, and I'm just wondering how long you were making these covers before you saw any type of monetary or like tangible results from it. Because I find a lot of times people, they start a channel, they start a website, and they just don't stick with it long enough. But I mean, you've got over hundreds of videos, right?
Yeah. And I guess I sort of have to admit that I haven't been the best about seeing any you know, any monetary gain out of it. That's just something that I've never really brought myself to pursue when maybe I could have, but that's just kind of something that I haven't really found time to do with the videos. But the biggest thing I think has just been kind of building up the courage to send these videos, because most of them are arrangements or covers of songs that I already like, and kind of just building up the courage to actually send these videos to the original artists, which I always kind of just go out on a limb when I do that, and I never really expect that anyone's going to respond. After I started doing that, which was pretty soon after I started making them in general, I found that people who I thought wouldn't be responsive were actually very responsive, and it just developed a lot of relationships that I don't think I would have developed without having that. So I think pretty much from the beginning, I started sending the videos to the people who I thought would dig it. So whether it was like the drummer that played on the track, or whether it was the person who wrote it or whatever. Yeah, just kind of starting to build those relationships from the beginning. And I think that could also apply to our world too. Like if you, in the case of like Rod playing on Chain Melody, like if you film a video of you playing a David Lang piece, just like, even if you don't know if they're going to respond, just send it to David Lang and be like, hey, check it out, I did a video of your thing. And I've found more often than not that people are just really excited to see people taking initiative with creative projects with their pieces, and they're really appreciative of seeing videos sent to them.
Yeah, wonderful. Evan, is there anything we could plug for you? And I mentioned the CDs, but is there something coming up? Shoot a plug out there.
Yeah, so Square Peg is working on a new album coming up, but we have two full lengths and a 5-track ambient EP. Speaking of sound healing, it's very slow moving and no drums or anything. Those are all available on iTunes and Bandcamp and Spotify. 410, you know, if you just follow us on social media, we're always posting new music videos that we're working on. We're about to have a screening of an official music video that we did tomorrow, which is Monday, at Le Poisson Rouge in New York City. Social media is the best way to stay up to date with those projects.
I had a quick follow-up question to that. I remember a while back, I think on Facebook, I saw something about you performing at Le Poisson Rouge with Ian Rosenbaum involved or something. Am I making this up?
I think the show that you might be thinking of was in...
Or maybe Ian did one of your pieces. I feel like there was like a snare drum with lights.
Yeah, Ian, I think what you're thinking of is the percussion festival at National Sawdust. Does that sound familiar? Yeah. Okay, yeah. Ian and Andy Akiho put on this amazing percussion festival that I think has become an annual thing. And it's just like an amazing all-day festival of a whole bunch of percussionists. And I've played it 2 years now. I played Monkey Chant by Glenn Cochi. I think that was 2 years ago. And then this past year, my group Square Peg played, and I also played a solo that I wrote for snare drum and lights.
Great stuff. Hey, well, thanks so much to everyone who sent us some questions. Some of you didn't read your questions out aloud, but I think we did get everything covered in there. So Adam Hopper, Brian Bloom, Daniel Seibert, Ben Millison, and Brandon Arve. So, hey, thanks so much, Megan and Ben and Evan Chapman. Man, it's great to talk to you again, and congratulations on all this cool stuff you're doing.
Thank you so much. Yeah, and thank you for having on the show.
Cool. Okay, everyone, we'll catch you on 107. Take it easy.